Welcome to Fraud Talk, the Association of Certified Fraud Examiners monthly podcast. During this time, we will be going inside case studies, talking with the industry's leading experts on fraud, and giving you the tools you need to do your job better. In our inaugural podcast today, we talk to Jay Dottie, CFE, CMA, and President of Griffin Strategies in New York, about a case he worked on that not only ended in a civil conviction, but also a recovery of more than half of the funds lost to fraud. Jay has worked in finance, accounting, and investigations for more than 20 years, and frequently speaks on financial fraud investigation and prevention. He recently contributed this case he worked on a few years ago with Angela Clancy to our new bribery and corruption casebook. Through a combination of old-school investigative techniques and the latest data analytics software, Jay and Angela were able to get back $3 million of the original $4.4 million loss for a client who fell victim to a kickback scheme, as well as a fraudulent purchasing and billing scheme. Jay, why don't you start at the beginning? How did you initially get involved with Brewcor and the investigation of its employees?
So the company we did the work for, Brewcorp, it's a coffee roasting company, and we had done a number of cases for them over the years. They had actually been the victim of many frauds over the years, as a lot of smaller companies have been. They've had employees stealing cash. They had truck drivers stealing payments on their routes. So just about, you know, everything that could be perpetrated against a company had been attempted in the past. So the client we had a longstanding relationship with, we had done a lot of prior investigative work for, and as part of that work, you know, because they had some of these problems and they have a product that can be stolen rather easily, we helped to install a security system on site, and that included both video cameras and key card access and security alarms, and everything was sort of tied together. So, you know, they had a pretty good security system in place. This particular owner was very, very sensitive to employees stealing from the company, and because he'd had all these prior incidents, he is a guy who took it seriously and wanted to try to contain his losses. So in this particular case, they had a declining, over the last 3 to 5 years, declining profit margins, which the owner had been in the company for a long time. His family had owned the business, and he didn't, you know, he was not a financial guy. He was a product guy. And, you know, he didn't quite understand why the margins were declining. Their sales had been going up, but the margins were, you know, kind of narrowing each year. And, of course, that hit his bottom line, so he was concerned about that. So he called in a couple of his accountants, the CFO and an accountant who worked for her, to do some analysis and try to figure out why these margins were declining. And, you know, they came back and basically said that, you know, repair costs had been going up because they hadn't invested in new plant technology and equipment. And, you know, that was essentially the explanation.
Which kind of sounded plausible. I mean, it sounded...
Right. Yeah, and the owner, you know, Billy Hayes, that's what he thought at the time, too. He himself had not wanted to invest in some of the technology and the upgrades in equipment because he was nearing the end of his career. He wanted to, you know, take his money and run. So he was a little embarrassed that that was the explanation. He sort of blamed himself. But, you know, there was a fairly noticeable decrease in the margin. So he still wasn't 100% convinced that that was a problem. And he didn't really like the explanation that they gave him. They seemed a little nervous and sort of unsure of themselves.
Let's stop right there for 1 second. That apprehension that he had, or the paranoia, how important or vital is that when you're a president of a company like this?
I think it's pretty important. You have to be skeptical, and you have to ask questions, and you have to try to get to the bottom of questions when they come up. So, you know, you can't spend all your time second-guessing your employees or you know, trying to figure out what's going on the ground level. But when you do have issues that arise, it's important to ask the questions and to get the right answers. And if you're not satisfied with the answers you get, to do whatever you need to do to get comfortable with them.
So after hearing from his CFO and accountant, President Billy Hayes wasn't satisfied with the answers he was getting about the profit margins. You then start using the preventative monitoring devices you had previously installed and discovered something fairly quickly. After viewing the surveillance tapes, what did you find out?
What really was the trigger point in this investigation is that one of the accountant that actually provided most of the explanation, this guy Luke Smith, came into the office at 1 a.m. On a Sunday, and this was, you know, the week after Billy Hayes had this confrontation with Smith and Sandy Dawson, the CFO. And so it was just really suspicious timing. Now, the security system was set up that, you know, when people enter the premise at odd times, we would get an email, we could check the cameras. And so, when you looked at the two things in tandem, you know, both this explanation about the declining margins and, you know, what was this guy doing in there, you know, for 2 hours on Sunday at 1 a.m., it raised the question, is something going on here?
What kind of guy was Luke Smith? He seems like he looked good, he sounded good, he looked like an ideal employee in the beginning.
Extremely smart, diligent, always did great analysis. One thing they didn't do is they didn't do pre-employment background, so they didn't know, you know, who they were hiring. They just knew the guy was really smart. He was a great accountant. He always had the right answers. He was very cool under pressure. They put a lot of trust in him. The CFO was a longtime CFO. She was nearing retirement, and I think it was a relief to her to have somebody really good that could perform analysis and do things. So a lot of times she wouldn't question his analysis or look any deeper. It was just convenient to have this this employee that could take care of things.
So you and Angela began to look at the data. What did it reveal?
First thing we looked at, you know, not that sophisticated, was just what was Smith doing there. What transactions did he do in the general ledger when he was there? And we found that he had processed some invoices for a company called Exile Industries, which was one of their parts suppliers. So it fit into this category of repair costs that was the explanation for the declining margins. So right away it looked sort of interesting to us. And, you know, the question was, why would somebody go in at 1 a.m. on a Sunday to process invoices? So, you know, right away, big red flag.
Was he ever confronted early on with why did you come in, or did y'all just immediately start investigating and then wait?
Yeah, we waited. We didn't confront him first. In most investigations, you want to try to get as much information and facts as you can before you, you confront the subject. So, you know, we wanted to get our arms around what the story was before we approached him. Obviously, that processing of those invoices was a red flag. We put it aside at first. You know, I knew that we wanted to look into Exile Industries a little bit, do some background investigation, determine who they were. But we did some other data analytics first. We looked at the emails as well to see if, you know, what kind of email traffic there was. Both of the CFO, Dawson, at that time she was under suspicion as well, but of Smith as well. And, you know, the correspondence between the two of them were pretty ordinary.
But that's when you saw Jane Brown.
That's right. So we saw a lot of correspondence between Smith and Jane Brown, who was an engineer. And it was a little odd that they would be having that much correspondence, given their positions. And as we looked at it more, it looked like they had a relationship between the two of them. And there were some indications that they were talking about invoice processing. And the other thing that we saw, that both of them, and this was through using the data analytics tools, you could kind of look at the pattern of emails. You know, we saw that they had a common third party that they had a lot of email traffic with, and that was this ghostwriter@gmail.com address. That was another one of the big red flags. You know, we had this Exile payment. We also had all this common traffic to this third party. So, you know, right away we wanted to figure out who was behind that third party. Now, we couldn't, you know, it wasn't obvious. There wasn't, you know, any email directories that would you know, would turn up who that was. It's pretty easy for anybody to create an email address without identifiers. So that was just one of those things we flagged and said, okay, we've got to get back to this and figure out who this is. In the meantime, we did some additional investigation of Exile Industries, did some background investigation there, sort of standard stuff, public records, litigation histories, judgments, liens, et cetera. And we found out that Exile had actually filed a bankruptcy 3 years earlier. So, you know, that was obviously a huge red flag. This company's been bankrupt for 3 years. This guy's coming in at 1 a.m. on a Sunday and making payments to this company. You know, what the hell's going on here?
So you also, in those emails, saw the name Wild Bill.
That's right, yeah. I'm sorry. In some of the emails, there were references to Wild Bill. You know, no full name, but there was this Wild Bill. So we were obviously curious who the heck Wild Bill was.
Did you initially think that Wild Bill was Ghostwriter?
You know, it looked like it, yeah. It looked like from the emails that the two were tied together, it was Wild Bill. But, you know, we had no inclination who Wild Bill was. Somebody asked me in one of the presentations whether we thought it was the owner, Billy Hayes. And honestly, it didn't occur to me until somebody asked that question, but we didn't have that suspicion. But as, you know, as we did the background into Exile, you know, we pulled the corporate records, we pulled the bankruptcy information, and it became clear that the guy that owned Exile was William Panetta. So, you know, right
Wild
away,
Bill.
We figured, hey, that's got to be Wild Bill. So, you know, at that point, we knew we were on to something. The other thing that came up when we investigated both Exile and Panetta is that Panetta had a history of financial problems. Obviously, his company had gone bankrupt 3 years ago. He had some outstanding judgments and liens from a few years ago. But then all of a sudden, and more recently, he had made a very high-end automobile purchase. He bought a Mercedes Roadster.
Yeah.
So this guy's financial condition had changed drastically over the last 3 years, from being really poor, his company going bankrupt, to buying a new automobile for cash, it looked like, for over $100,000. So, you know, we knew something fishy was going on here. We knew he was behind Exile. At that point, we had the two connected. We knew that there was this connection to Wild Bill. We looked further then at the invoices for Exile, because obviously they were a suspect party. So we went back several years and looked at all the invoices that were paid at Exile, and it turned out that only one person had approved those invoices, and that was Jane Brown. So she was an engineer, and she would have been responsible for keeping the production line going, implementing new parts into the production line, doing repairs and maintenance. So it wasn't totally out of the ordinary that she would have been ordering parts from Exile, but the fact that she approved all the purchases sort of stood out. When you looked at other vendors in that same area, a number of other people approved the purchases.
And she also approved them, in a non-standard way, right?
That's right. That didn't come out until a little bit later on, but from the data, we could see that, she was the one approving all the invoices from Exile. And, we did some analysis on the payments to Exile over the last 5 years. And it was about $6 million. So at that point, we said, we knew there was a problem here, but we wanted to talk to people, do some interviews of other people in the company to determine, how did this happen? How could she circumvent the normal process? And so we started with the receiving department, and we interviewed the head of the receiving department, a guy, Brian Jones was his name. He let us know that, they had all these problems with the production line, so it wasn't uncommon from Brown to get the parts directly, as opposed to them going through the normal receiving process where they would be cataloged and entered into the system by the receiving department. They would be received directly by Brown, and then she would just let them know that she'd received the parts. And she did that by providing them with FedEx documentation that the shipments had come in. And her excuse was, hey, I can't wait for you guys to receive these parts and log everything in and then, get the parts to me the next day. I've got to get these parts and keep this production line going.
So in hindsight, was that a red flag?
It's a big red flag. I mean, that's why procedures like receiving and, other internal controls exist, so you can catch problems like this or you can prevent them from happening. The fact that they circumvented this control, really allowed this fraud to take place and continue over a number of years. So that was a big problem. And, when we found out that she had been going around the process, then it became clear how she was able to do this. We got the FedEx documentations from the receiving people, and we compared those to, we were able to access FedEx documentation as well, and we compared the two, and it was clear that the FedEx documentation that Brown had provided was fictitious. It didn't exist. So, pretty clear what was happening here.
So you decided to go after Wild Bill, the president of Exile, first in the interviewing process. Why did you see him as the weakest link in the fraud?
We thought he might be the weakest link. He was outside of the company, first of all, and we were able to convince him that the owner really didn't care about him. He was outside of the company, but the owner wanted to go after the people inside the company who were responsible for this, the employees that he trusted. So, we used that argument with Panetta. We laid out some of the evidence that we had, and he didn't fight too hard. He knew he knew that we had him, and he went ahead and explained the scheme to us. So he was the weakest link of the three, and he gave us a lot of details about how the fraud occurred. It originally started out as a kickback scheme before Exile went bankrupt. Jane Brown had actually come to him and said, listen, we'll increase your sales if you kick us back 20%, and he could even raise his prices by 20%. So he did that for a few years, was able to make some money that way, but his He was sort of a sad sack guy. His wife had left him. He had gone through a divorce. He had a lot of financial problems aside from this account. Exile was not doing well, so he had a lot of financial problems. And once he went bankrupt, Brown came to him and said, listen, I know you're bankrupt, but here's one way we can help you out. Instead of kickbacks on legitimate shipments of parts, we'll just make this an outright fictitious vendor scheme.
Faced with the overwhelming evidence collected by Jay and Angela, Wild Bill quickly unraveled and gave up the details of the fraud. He was given a lesser sentence for his inside information, but ultimately ended up behind bars with Jane and Luke. Because of Jay's surveillance and investigation know-how and Angela's data analytics skills, law enforcement and attorneys had everything they needed to convict. As Jay mentions in the bribery and corruption casebook, the case was handed over to police wrapped up in a bow. However, what makes this case significant was what happened after the trial. Brewcorp president Billy Hayes was like any other wronged victim. He not only wanted justice, he wanted his money back. Using bank records, Jay and Angela tracked some of the money to banks in the U.S., but several statements stood out from the rest. Payments to a marina in the Hamptons. The harbor master at the marina recognized Jane's and Luke's photographs and even remembered the 50-foot yacht they moored there before moving it to the Caribbean. Surveillance revealed that the couple had traveled to the island of Tortola several times, and lo and behold, Jay and Angela found not only the boat, but more than $900,000 in a fake corporation's bank account. While this case had a relatively happy ending, with Hayes getting back almost $3 million of the stolen $4.4 million, not all victims fare as well. But as Jay pointed out, the red flags were there, and the case provides several lessons learned. Number one, conduct background checks on employees and third-party vendors. Checks on Jane and Luke may not have revealed anything, as these were their first offenses, but a check on Exile Industries would have shown a bankrupt company receiving invoices and a destitute owner buying a new Mercedes. Number two, prevention works. Because of Jay's surveillance measures put in place before the fraud, he was able to get a lead on Luke when he saw him come into work on Sunday at 1 a.m. to send out a few emails. And finally, number three, circumventing processes and procedures isn't always just laziness or ineptitude. It could be something bigger. Digging deeper into why Jane went around normal operating procedures with the FedEx purchasing invoices might have saved Brewcorp some money and stopped the fraud sooner. Thank you for listening to Fraud Talk, and we hope you join us next month. For more information about the bribery and corruption casebook mentioned in this podcast, visit acfe.com.